stances and positions regarding your nuclear power, because this is the trust we did on the U.S., Great Britain, and the Russia Federation, mm-hmm. and now this is happening to us.
You know, there is a verse in the Quran,
yes.
that الشَّيْطَانُ يَعِدُكُمُ الْفَقْرِ. The Satan gives you the promise of hunger.
Mm. Yes.
You know, in reality, maybe in front of you, he says, like, I will protect you. Mm-hmm. Do not pray to God. Do not do this. Do not do that. But at the end, when it is the time you need help from the Satan,
he deceives you.
He deceives you, yeah. and he will not help you, and the hunger will come Remind, after you.
Yes.
Now, Ukraine is being, you know, involved in hunger.
Rapper on Eden Mabas talked about taking lesson from history. You know, I mean, tajrubai tarikhi, taking lesson from history and the experiences that other countries had, and he named different lands, you know. For example, Afghanistan was one of them. You know, the then president of Afghanistan, when he was toppled down and he fled away, in an interview, he talked against the U.S., that U.S. did this and did that, promised me this and promised that. Okay, we'll eliminate hunger from your country. Famine, something like that, but none of them happened.
Yeah. We have chapter 2, verse number 267.
Yes,
it says, "الشيطان يعدكم الفقر ويأمركم بالفحشاء."
Mm-hmm.
You know, Shaitan promises you of the hunger, and he orders you to the indecency, immorality.
Yes.
Wallahu, but Allah, and Allah, يعدكم المغفرة.
Yes.
He promises you the forgiveness. Minhu, from him, وفضله. And obviously the bounty, wallahu wasi'un alim. So basically, it is very important to know the taghut, to know your enemy.
Yes.
That was the right thing. But in the methodology, obviously, we have many people who wants to get involved into this jihad.
Yes.
But the first thing is you need to load yourself with the proper weapon for this war. It is a war.
Yes.
This soft war is a war,
mm-hmm.
and it is not less than the hard war that we had.
Yes.
Obviously, you need to get prepared. You need to load yourself with the proper weapon. If it is the knowledge, you need to get knowledge. It is upon you. If it is about to, learn different, applications or the softwares, how to deal with it, how to run, or the social media, how to use it.
Yes.
You need to do it.
You know, the thing that they're doing now, I don't know, have you heard about the Meta Universe or not? The Metaverse and the Meta Project, okay, is a project that the giants of high-tech are doing in order to establish, create the goggles that you put on your eyes, and then you enter into a world which is absolutely based on the virtual science,
virtual
and
science.
You can make your land, you can buy it. And you know,
the same company who built the Bitcoin and all those, now they're selling the properties. For example, Taj Mahal has been already sold over there.
Yes, virtual property.
The virtual land.
Yes. And they said that this will finish the corruption. Why? Because everyone knows what you own.
Yes.
So no one can, take it from you. No one can invade you. You know, they cannot crack. The point is, the one who has made this software can crack you. He already has bought everything for himself.
Has got into your mind, through the goggles. You can make your own personality, even with your own characteristics. If you are short in this world, you can make a tall person out of yourself. If you are, I don't know. You
I remember
this,
there was a movie as well.
Yes.
Hollywood made it.
Yes,
like,
yes.
Used to put, they were on the computer.
Play,
they used to put
Player One. Player One by Steven Spielberg.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
Player One, yeah. So
player
in
one.
That,
Game
they put
one.
The goggles, they don't
yes,
have
yes.
the real, in the real world, they don't know each other. They're always
That's
you know, got involved in that. The general public, they have different, those who are involved in the IT, they have different, methods. The lawyers, the politicians, they have their own, duties to, they have their own duties to, to perform. So therefore, the methodologies are different. And at this point, obviously, it is hard to just identify. We can identify a couple of them, but not all of them.
Yes.
We cannot just talk about all of them.
Okay.
But obviously, it should be, whatever we do, it should be first, be prioritized.
Yes.
First of all, you cannot just do anything. You cannot just put hand in anything. Number two, it should be, in line with the Islamic revolution. Because that's the lesson which we learned, obviously.
It should be in line.
It should be in line with the Islamic revolution.
Okay.
It should be with the scientific and logical support and expertise. It cannot be without that. And be practical. Sometimes we want to do something, but in practical life, we are lazy. So your practice and what you think should be the same. And the last thing, but not least, avoid corruption and sedition. sometimes we think that, okay, someone has put a material about me on the internet or somewhere else. I need to save Islam, for example. I cannot put something which is based on lies against that person. You know, the corruption, this is a kind of corruption. Mm-hmm. So it shouldn't be...
So this jihad tabi must be ethical too.
That is important. Yes. It should be ethical and true. Because yes. Islam is the religion of truth.
Yes.
So we don't need any lies.
We do not play the dirty game
which they are doing. Yeah. We don't need that.
We don't need that.
When it comes to the tools required, one is, as Sayyid has mentioned too, the adequate knowledge, right?
Yes.
Being empowered with the knowledge and knowing the subject you're addressing. The second is the ability to promote the correct intellectual discourse,
mm-hmm.
right? Knowledge in itself, which is all over the place, is not enough, right? So you have to develop, and if you already have it, good. If not, then you have to develop the ability to promote the correct intellectual discourse.
That's right.
The third one is the ability to follow the proper reasoning and principles of logic. Sometimes people, when they get into this confrontational situation, they put aside logic.
They become emotional
yes. and just, that doesn't help.
Yes.
The fourth one is Islamic akhlaq, as the leader himself has mentioned, the ethics and morals, which, involves and includes taqwa and sincerity.
That's right.
This is something that's a prerequisite for anyone to enter into this jihad.
Mm-hmm.
Without this, you're going to do more damage than benefit.
Yes.
Then acquaintance with social media tools and techniques.
Yes, like, this is important.
This is very important. If you're going to use it as a means to get to people, you need to know how to work it.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not the least is access to verifiable information, data, and yes. subject matter experts.
That's all right. It's really, I think, a specialized teamwork in order to be done on Jihad al-Tabin. I hope that different groups of the people and those who are interested in this concept, come into the field and, come into the practical aspects of Jihad al-Tabin, because here and there we can see so many people on the members, on the, sermons, giving lectures on the universities and the houses, talking about this. But first of all, we have to understand what is Jihad al-Tabin, what are the categories, what are the main tools. Recently, a book also have been published titled as Jihad al-Tabin by Intisharat Inqilab Islami, Islamic Revolution publication, compiled by Sayyid Sulh Mirzai,
right.
Which is a great book, I think. It is about more than 500 pages. It is in Farsi language. I hope it's been translated into English language, other languages too. It's a good book, on Jihad al-Tabin and what Rapper has emphasized on different aspects of this Jihad al-Tabin. Jihad for or of clarification explanation. Okay, thank you much.
You're welcome.
Sheikh Ali, really fruitful discussion. And Sayyid Mohsen, thank you. And thank you much, dear listeners, for listening to us to another episode. God bless you all. Fi amanullah.
Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
Palestinian children are being robbed of their futures, their bodies, their families, their ability to dream, but still they hold on. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Please stay tuned for the second part. Middle East Eye wrote, last month, 14-year-old Mo'in Ghassan Fahed Salahat became the youngest Palestinian held under administrative detention without charge or trial, based on secret evidence that neither he nor his lawyer can see. His detention can be renewed indefinitely. This isn't an exception. It's the rule. From the start of the Second Intifada until 2015 alone, more than 13,000 Palestinian children were arrested by Israeli regime forces. Thousands more are killed. According to Defense for Children International Palestine, at least 2,427 Palestinian children were killed by Israeli regime forces between the Second Intifada and mid-2024, excluding those killed in Gaza after October 7, 2023. The killings span decades, checkpoints, refugee camps, and cities. The scale of the violence cannot be dismissed as collateral damage. It is policy, repeated, institutionalized, and refined. The cruelty extends beyond violence. It infects language. In late 2023, during a hostage exchange, Israeli captives were traded for Palestinian prisoners, many of them minors. But the British media and even The Guardian initially would not call them children. Instead, they were referenced as teens or people aged 18 and younger. Such deliberate euphemisms reflect a quiet erasure. Strip them of childhood and you strip them of sympathy. Strip them of innocence and their cages require no keys. This isn't rhetorical carelessness. It's part of an ideological strategy to recast Palestinian children as threats, not victims. If they aren't children, killing them isn't a crime, and mourning them isn't necessary. This erasure didn't begin yesterday. It's decades old. During the First Intifada in 1987 to 93, children rose with stones in their hands. The Israeli regime response was blunt force doctrine, Yitzhak Rabin. Then the war minister ordered the Zionist regime troops to break their bones, and they did. Footage showed children held down, their arms shattered by rocks in the Zionist regime's hands. This wasn't chaos, it was command. That same logic lives on, no longer with sticks, but with missiles and white phosphorus. The bone breaking has become mass amputation. The aim is the same, to cripple the future. That legacy found one of its clearest symbols in the death of Mohammad Adore. In 2000, at the start of the Second Intifada, the 12-year-old crouched beside his father behind a barrel south of Gaza City. His father shielded him with his body, but the boy was hit multiple times by Israeli regime gunfire. He died in his father's arms. The moment was filmed and the world watched. The Zionist regime denied, spun, blamed, but the truth endured. A child was executed while the world looked on. Then came Fares Odeh. At just 14, he stood alone before an Israeli regime tank, a stone in his hand, his body arched in defiance. Days later, he was shot in the neck and killed near Gaza's Karni crossing. The photo of a boy facing down an army, stone raised in his hand, is etched into Palestinian memory. They killed him, but his image lives on. Indeed, the targeting of children has long been Israeli regime doctrine. From the 1948 Deir Yassin massacre to the 1970 bombing of an Egyptian school in Bahr al-Baghir to the 2006 strike in Lebanon's Ghana, which killed dozens. Even in the moments of supposed calm, the killing continues. In 2015, Israeli settlers firebombed the Dawabsha family home in occupied West Bank. 18-month-old Ali was burnt alive. Later, Israelis danced at a wedding, stabbing a photo of the dead baby in celebration. Today, Israeli regime politicians and rabbis speak of Palestinian children as enemies. A rabbi called for killing them without hesitation. A member of the Knesset declared that every child born in Gaza was already a terrorist. Child killer Netanyahu invoked the biblical tale of Amalek to frame mass death, including the killing of children, as a divine duty. An official with the UN Committee on the Rights of the Child said of the situation in Gaza, "The outrageous death of children is almost historically unique. These are extremely grave violations that we do not often see." But the world has seen, and still, the small bodies pile higher. This is not just genocidal in numbers. It's genocidal in intent. And it doesn't end with killing and maiming. It reaches deeper to memory and imagination. Those who survive are stripped of their childhood, their schools reduced to rubble, their teachers buried beneath chalkboards. More than 80% of Gaza's schools have been damaged or destroyed. Even playgrounds have been flattened, swings twisted into scrap, football fields cratered by missiles. As long as there are children, Palestine lives.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brother, dear sister, salam. So welcome to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. Thank you very much for choosing this program to listen to, in which we're going to speak about the Holy Quran in life. من الآيات والتفسير ويسقي العقل والتفكير يواكب واقع التغيير يشيد بالوئام صروح يشيد بالوئام صروح يشيد بالوئام صروح Today, Wednesday, 3rd of Shawwal, 1446 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 13th of Farvardin, 1404 of the Islamic Solar Hijri calendar, and the 2nd of April, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. As usual, and as the ritual of this program, we open Allah's book, the Holy Quran, and we'll listen to chapter An'am, verse 19.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Qul ayyu shay'in akbar shahadah. Qul illah shahidun bayni wa baynakum. وأوحي إلي هذا القرآن لأنذركم به ومن بلغ أئنكم لتشهدون أن مع الله آلهة أخرى قل لا أشهد قل إنما هو إله واحد وإن
Say, what thing is greatest in testimony? Say, Allah is witness between me and you, and this Quran was revealed to me that I may warn you thereby and whomever it reaches. Do you truly testify that with Allah there are other deities? Say, I will not testify with you. Say, indeed, he is but one God, and indeed, I am free of what you associate with him.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
Besides all other prophetic miracles, unseen aids, and frustrating the hostile plots, the Quran itself is the greatest evidence to the Prophet's messengership. The messengership of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his pure family, is both worldly and eternal for all humankind and in all ages. However, a permanent warning indeed should be accomplished with an everlasting warner. Therefore, the divine imamate and leadership should also be together with the Quran forever.
إن القرآن لنور يتفجر في جنباتي يرفعني عند مليك الخلق لأعلى الدرجات
إن القرآن لنور
يتفجر في جنباتي يرفعني عند مليك الخلق لأعلى الدرجات
قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي قرآني عصمة أمري قرآني طوق نجاتي قرآني نبض حياتي قرآني طهر ذاتي قرآني عصمة أمري قرآني طوق نجاتي.
As I told you, the topic of this episode of today's special is about Quran in our life. The teachings of the Quran, when implemented correctly, significantly impact everyday life by prohibiting negative behavior, such as alcohol consumption, drug use, adultery, gambling, jealousy, greed, and arrogance. It encourages individuals to abandon destructive habits and guides us to be conscious, compassionate, intellectual, respectful, and trustworthy, subservient to the commandments and decrees of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. In essence, the Quran is an eternal miracle gifted to this ummah via our beloved Prophet Muhammad, comprising the most significant speech of Allah applicable to all of men. Sayyid Muhammad Ridwi.
Imam Ali alayhi salam was not only talking, he wanted this to, he was dictating it. He wanted somebody to write it down. What he says, Wallah, Wallah fil Quran. He says, I remind you of Allah. I remind you of Allah regarding the Quran. Because that is our foundation. You know, there is, that is the only book in which they don't, we don't have any doubt about. Any other book, you know, we never use the term Sahih before it. Because all the books of Ahadith, we have to individually scrutinize them to see whether they are reliable or acceptable or not. But Quran is beyond any level of, you know, doubt or criticism as far as the integrity of the words of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is concerned. And so this is something we have to keep in mind at all the times. And Amir al-Mu'minin here, you see, the first five items, he didn't even talk about salat. He talked about taqwa. He talked about being organized in your affairs. He talked about making peace when there is dispute among you. He talked about orphans. He talked about neighbors. And then he talks about the Quran. And this is where, you know, then he comes to salat and hajj and jihad and, you know, family ties and amr bil ma'ruf and nahy al munkar. So when he talks about the Quran, he said something very profound. And I think we really have to seriously look at it. It has been 14 centuries. Maybe we collectively as an ummah, we have lost that. But individually, we still have the opportunity to live by this wasiyat. What does he say? He says, Wallah, Wallah, I remind you of Allah. I remind you of Allah. Fil Quran. Regarding the Quran, لا يسبقكم بالعمل به غيركم. It shouldn't be that others implement the Quran before you.
IRIB English Radio presents today's special, Every Day for 15 Minutes.
Be like the sun shining with light. Be like a rose spreading its fragrance in every part.
Today's special.
Be like the earth, humble and wise. Be like the rain, pouring all your love to every soul.
Now, what attitude should I have towards the Quran? All of us have a set of preconceived notions and perceptions about life. Quran and Islam that we gather from our respective cultures and societies. If we read the Quran thinking that we already know the truth, we will not gain true benefit from it. We'll only be able to grasp the message if we open our mind for it. When approaching the Quran, we shall cast aside our perceptions and try to understand the Quran as it was understood by the infallible Imams. Moreover, when the Quran says something that contradicts our beliefs, it is our beliefs that we must change and not the Quran. Those who are not willing to accept the teachings as they are, try to twist them to suit their own and take verses out of context to justify their actions and positions. This leads to misguidance instead of guidance. And the Quran mentions that some people are indeed misguided by it.
هذا القرآن يوحدنا لطريق الخير يوجهنا الله تعالى أنزله ورسول الله معلمنا ورسول الله معلمنا هذا القرآن لطريق الخير يوجهنا
this part of today's special, we have some tips to improve our understanding of the Holy Quran. One of the tips is make dua or supplications. Before reading the Quran, ask Allah to guide you. Your goal is to connect with Allah genuinely for the love of Allah through study, understand, and applying His wonderful words. Making a dua to Allah for assistance and guidance will be our most significant tool for doing this. Allah has promised to grant our request whenever we draw close to Him and offer a dua to Him. Let's end this episode of today's special by this verse from chapter Al-Baqarah. When my servants ask you, O Prophet, about me, I'm truly near. I respond to one's prayer when they call upon me. So let them respond with obedience to me and believe in me. Perhaps they will be guided to the right way.
Today we want to look at a tradition, a hadith from the Messenger of Allah, the Prophet Muhammad, may God's peace and blessings be upon him and his family, in which he gives us a beautiful similitude of the Quran in our hearts. And he gives us an antidote to clear and to purify and to remove any of the impurities which may have built upon our hearts over the last 11 months. And the Prophet says the following in this tradition. These hearts, just like iron, become rusted. And the way to remove this rust, the way to clean the rust from the hearts, is through the recitation of the Quran. I'm sure all of us have seen rust build up on metal tools, for example, that we might use in our garden, or for example, in our cars, or in many different things that have stayed outside, and the elements, you know, the water gets to it, the air, all of these chemicals get to these products and items that we might use in our gardens or around the house on a day-to-day basis. And they develop a covering over top of them, whether it be rust or something else. And obviously when we have that rust buildup, we tend to want to clean it, to polish it. If it's some tarnish on a utensil, we want to polish it to make it look nice. If it's something that we're using, let's say in the garden, we might want to remove the rust from that to allow that tool to last longer, so it doesn't rot away, whatever the case may be. And so the noble messenger in this tradition shows us that just like these things develop a coating that we want to remove, similar do our hearts develop this coating, this rust, this impurity upon it. Many times we don't have really an opportunity to connect to Allah fully with a full focus and devotion to Him. We all lead obviously busy lives, and sometimes things just don't work out for us. And so we sometimes shirk in our responsibilities and our commitment to the faith. But definitely each and every single believer make an extra point to recite the Quran, to engage in extra worship. And as the messenger says, that the way to clean this rust from our heart, the way to polish our heart and remove any spiritual impurities which may have developed within it, is to engage in the recitation of the noble Quran. And so with such a reward promised to us, not only this numerical reward, but also a benefit of removing the rust from our hearts.
That was today's special from IRIB English Radio. We leave you in Allah's care. Fi amanillah.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Rabbi, Muhammad Nabi, Aliyun Imami. La fata illa Ali, Aliyun Imami, Aliyun Imami, Aliyun Imami. محمد نبي علي.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. Sorba International Media Festival.
Part 2.
In an era where mainstream media often glosses over the intricacies of our world, documentary filmmakers play a crucial role in revealing deeper truth. Today, we have the privilege of speaking with a distinguished filmmaker and producer whose body of work includes several significant documentaries that have not only informed but also inspired audiences, a man whose commitment to uncovering untold stories and presenting them with authenticity has made his work distinguished. I am Bahman Nouri, your host, and this is another episode of SOAP.
Murtaza Shahbani, born in 1964 in Iran, is a distinguished cinematographer and film producer. He began his career in the film industry in 1994 and has since worked on notable projects such as Abu Zainab, Curse My Little Homeland, and Woman with Gunpowder Earrings. Shahbani is known for his collaboration with prominent artists like Carmen Lebes, Bassem Magnia, Omar Shalk, and Yusuf Haddad. His expertise and dedication have earned him recognition in the Iranian film industry.
Mr. Murtaza Shahbani, very good to have you on the show.
Hello to you and the dear audience. Thank you for having me on your show.
It is indeed a pleasure for us to have you here. That is really impressive and that perfectly fits the bill as a filmmaker of resistance. Do you call yourself that?
All of my works are only about the resistance genre. Whether in the Holy Defense period, where I worked as a videographer assistant, videographer or photographer. And even after that, I continued my works in line with the resistance genre, especially in 2012 when Islamic Awakening formed, the crisis in Syria became serious, and ISIS attacked Iraq. With the help of my old friends, we established the Verity Documentary Center organization, and during these last 12 or 13 years, all of our movies have been about the resistance genre. They have covered Lebanon, Iraq, Syria, and even Yemen. I couldn't go to Yemen, but I sent one of our filmmakers there, and we made a few works. Some of them were made from a long distance, while others were made in the region. Now I'm honored to say that there is a movie titled Angels Don't Die in the Fajr Film Festival. This is a documentary movie that was, in fact, produced from a long distance. We instructed the filmmakers and videographers in Gaza Strip on how and what to record. They sent us the footage and we made a documentary out of it. I'm very pleased to have the honor to work in the resistance genre.
I want to talk about the emergence of Daesh terrorist group. Of course, you know how difficult, you know better than anybody else, how difficult it was and it must have been to make a film in that area, in those realms. Very, very difficult. But you made a documentary which was so well received and highly acclaimed. Women with gunpowder earrings, working on a film about the aftermath and the consequences of Daesh, such a phenomenon, a work of art. How did you come up with the idea?
Well, a huge incident was happening in the region. ISIS might be the biggest terrorist group in the world because there isn't any group as powerful as ISIS. At that time, ISIS had attacked Iraq and captured several territories, and the popular mobilization forces were trying to drive them out of the country. We, as documentary filmmakers of crisis and resistance, feel the responsibility to show what is going on in Iraq to our people and the whole world. We sent numerous filmmakers to Iraq, with the most successful one being Mr. Farahmand, the director of this work. He went to Iraq, conducted a brief investigation, and decided that he wanted to make a documentary on the families of ISIS men. I was really satisfied. We can't just remove the support, especially the emotional support, from their families and consider ISIS in isolation because the men fighting for ISIS must have wives, children, or families. What is the perspective of these families? Do they share the same beliefs as ISIS? Most cases reveal that they don't agree with their husbands, but they don't have any other choices. What does a crying baby know about war? How about takfir? There is actually a paradox that his father is fighting in war, killing others, or might be killed, but what is to blame on the child? What is the destiny and future of this family? This led to the Women with Gunpowder Earrings documentary. This was one of the most successful movies against ISIS, in my opinion, because it showed that ISIS, like other cases, has an ideology. We may be able to destroy ISIS, but what should we do with their families? How about a child who is in the middle of a dilemma with his father now dead and his family in captivity? What is the world's attitude towards them? Many of these people came from other countries like Russia, Chechnya, and Europe. How is Europe going to manage them? What should someone do when they leave their family to pursue their aspirations and now realize that it was all a lie and now they face a collapsed life? On the other side, the women have also lost their families, husbands, lives and futures. This is really pitiful. After this movie, we made another one that was showcased in the cinema Variety last year. The movie They is about families living in Iraqi camps, mostly foreigners from Europe whose countries and families no longer accept them. What should they do in Iraq, where they have no one? They are just leftovers. A documentary filmmaker is obligated to reflect these pains like a mirror, truly and honestly.
Your sensitivity on the matter shines through. You know, the way that you decided to work on an aspect of Daesh that nobody, or at least not so many people, thought about. That was very impressive. You decided to make a film about the families of a terror group. Of course, it must have been very challenging. Many of these ladies must have been very hard to convince to come in front of your camera. How did you overcome those challenges?
Filmmaking in a crisis is always dangerous. By crisis, I mean floods, earthquakes, and the worst one, war. The first step that a filmmaker takes to make a war documentary is to be prepared to set aside concerns of their own life and safety and do their job, which we call informing and enlightening audiences. You asked me how these families accepted to take part in the interview. A part of it derives from the documentary filmmaker's attitude. A filmmaker should live with the subject. Most of the time, when we want to conduct an interview, the answers are perfunctory. But when the filmmaker lives and understands the subject, the results are great. Of course, one of the positive points of this work is its narrator. The main element is this lady who works with the group. When a lady was supposed to interview the ladies, they were more comfortable. The other key element is the method that Arvini taught us, living with the subjects. It's not like it was made in a few days or a week. We spend lots of time making these documentaries, which even fascinates story documentary filmmakers. Take Copper Notes of a Dream documentary as an example, which took 60 days of shooting. It is not an easy task to live with a group of people who don't have proper living conditions and be like one of those in the war zone. This causes sympathy between us and them. We try not to judge in our documentaries. We just show the reality and leave the judgment to the people themselves.
And your unbiased position while making those films, as you said that you learned it from Martyr Avni, that the documentary maker must work like a mirror and not judge, nothing, just reflect the reality. Whatever it's in, whatever it sees in the society, you should just reflect that and leave the judgment with your audience. You did that, and it's very clear in your projects, but at the same time, it makes it kind of difficult to grasp, you know, what is, you know, how at the times where it becomes very critical, how do you still stay unbiased?
نمیتونیم بگیم بی طرفیم. ببینید فیلم ساز.
I can't say that I'm neutral. A filmmaker, whether from Iran or Europe, can't be neutral, but documentaries can be. As a filmmaker, while I'm in a dangerous region like where there is a conflict against ISIS, or during the holy defense where a soldier has a weapon in his hand and I have a camera, we have some feelings. I feel if I died, I would be considered a martyr. I can't go to the other side like Iraq or ISIS and start filming from that angle. In fact, I made my choice before something happened to me. You mentioned that when I'm on the resistance side, it means that I have chosen the ideology that I believe in, but I try to exclude this and avoid bias in what I'm presenting to the audience. When I stay neutral and don't take any sides, the audience can choose for themselves. Like two glasses of water, one filled with turbid water and the other with clear water. It is evident that proper sense will pick the clear water. We try to imply this. Actually, we just show the subject and the audience makes the decision.
That was indeed interesting, what you said about making a choice before actually getting involved with the project. That was very interesting to note. You've also made short films. How do you differ between documentary films and the other genres?
We had a class with Arvini and he posed a question. What is the difference between Chronicles of Victory and cinema? There were various answers, but Mr. Arvini's response was the best. He said that documentaries capture the truth and what is actually real. You may watch a really good movie in the cinema, but when you leave, you don't believe in it anymore. No matter how good it was, and even if you cried over it, you would simply say it was just a movie. But you don't say the same thing about documentaries. Documentaries are more soul-touching and have a lasting effect. For example, you can't forget women with gunpowder earrings. If this were a movie, it would end after one exhibition. Mr. Arvini continued, when someone does something tricky, people will say, don't make things up and don't lie. But this is not the same for documentaries. Documentaries are reality, a reality that you can't ignore. They are influential and leave a lasting impression.
It is very interesting that you stay true to factual storytelling, but at the same time, never leave out your artistic expression. How can you balance the two?
We try to approach cinema as a form of storytelling or narration. Narration is the key factor in Arvini's works, which he called the Chronicles of Victory, meaning a melancholic story. Over the years, we have insisted on maintaining this narration. We strive not to lose the story and to ensure it is present in all our works. The story should be real, not imaginary or fake. People have real stories, so there is no need to rely on our imagination. when we depict the lives of people such as those in Gaza, this is the story we tell. We shape it in a way that captures the audience's attention, keeping them interested and wondering what will happen next. With the help of a film editor, we create a documentary that keeps the audience's eyes glued to the screen.
Well, as we approach the end of our show, you have a moment to talk to our audience, who become your own audience right now, and talk to them directly. You can talk to the camera right behind me, to your own audience now.
Documentary is a wonderful world. In documentaries, just like in life, you have no clue what will happen next. We love and cherish documentaries because they drive us to constant learning. We are always learning, for as long as we live. You need to work in different places, under different conditions, dealing with new issues every day. This is what makes documentaries amazing. I find it really fascinating to meet different people and learn so much from each of them.
Mr. Murtaza Shabani, it was such a learning experience spending this time with you. I don't know, I did not even notice how time passed. Thank you for coming to the show.
Thank you for having me on your show.
And thank you for staying with us with another SORP. Until next time, it's goodbye from me, Bahman Urai.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
UN dismisses Israel's claim about sufficient food supplies in Gaza as ridiculous, saying all bakeries are closed due to lack of fuel and flour. The Yemeni army conducts a new anti-U.S. operation targeting an American aircraft carrier and its warships in the Red Sea with missiles and drones. And also in our headlines, Iran rejects Trump's threats about using military force to bomb Iranian nuclear sites, saying there is no military option regarding the country's nuclear program. Hello and welcome everybody here in the Iranian capital, Tehran. This is World News. Our top story, the Israeli regime continues its deadly and devastating assault on Gaza, killing and injuring more innocent Palestinians. Since the early hours of the morning, the death toll from Israel's relentless bombardment has risen to at least 21. An airstrike in the southern city of Khan Yunis claimed the lives of at least 13 Palestinians.